Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 1st. Welcome to March. I'm having fun. March 1st, and we are here wherever we are. We're all over. I think you're all in Denver. I am here, like I said, in Florida. We are at our weekly class, usually on Parshat Shavua. But today we are going to do something a little different. Today we're going to study an aspect of Megillat Esther, because next Tuesday night starts Purim, and I thought it would be nice for us to have a little bit of a deep dive into one element of the Purim story, and that specifically is what I hope to show is the development of Esther through the development of Esther's personality in the Megillah, and so that's what we're going to do. I'll share my screen, and we'll get started. Anyone have any questions along the way? As always, don't hesitate to just unmute yourself or put your raise your hand literally or virtually. And if there's any background noise, I apologize. I had to come into a semi-public area. I had to come into a semi-public area because the internet in the rooms is not really supporting Zoom so well. So I came downstairs into a little bit of a public area. So I apologize if there's any background noise. In any case, let's get started. So I'm going to start with a really interesting statement made by Esther, which is really the end. It's really where I want to end up. And that is at the end of the story, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah. Actually, I'm going to insert, I want to put source numbers if I can. Yeah, number sources. There we go. Okay, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, which is source number one. You can't see the source, but let me know. But source number one, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, tells us that Esther, Queen Esther, went to the rabbis and shalcha lahem. She sent a letter or a message or a text message or a WhatsApp or whatever it is that they were doing back then to the rabbis. And she said to them, Kitavuni Lidorot, I want you to make my book part of the Bible. Okay, at this point, the Bible was not canonized, meaning it wasn't yet clear. Right, which books were going to be in the Bible, which books were not going to be in the Bible. And Esther says, I want my book to be part of the Bible. I want it to be part of the canon, the official written documents, the Torah, Shebichtav of the Jewish people. I want to leave that with you as sort of a bold thing to do, right? It's sort of a gutsy move for someone to say, I want my story, right? The story that I played the center role in, right? I want that to be part of the forever story of the Jewish people. Okay. That is not something that a meek person would do, right? That does not at all sound like someone that is shy, not sure of themselves, not sure of their position, not sure of their importance or the importance of their story would do. And as I said, that to me is a bit of the punchline of the story. But how did we get there, right? How did we get to Esther being this person who could say, Kitavuni Lidorot, right? Make me part of the forever story of the Jewish people, especially considering Esther's beginning. So before we go on, right? First, let's read a little excerpt from an article that I relied on. This article developing some elements of this shiur by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the late Rosh Yeshiva Yeshiva Karatzio, where he writes as follows. This is source number two. Hence, anyone want to read? Can I get a volunteer to read? Can I volunteer someone to read?
I can do it.
Go, Stacey. Thank you.
Okay.
From where it says,
start with hence.
Yeah.
Hence the obligation of recording and reading the Megillah would seem to arise from a direct request by Esther that her story be set down for all generations. inscribe me, establish me. But the Megillah, in fact, recounts a story which unfolds in the public arena. It is the story of Esther. Is it the story of Esther alone? Surely it is the story of an entire nation dispersed throughout Ahasuerus's 127 provinces, faced with the threat of genocide. The story also involves other main characters, such as Mordechai. Okay, that's kind of small. Nevertheless, throughout history, this book has been known not as Megillat Yehudim, nor even Megillat Mordechai, but rather Megillat Esther.
Okay, so two comments here. So first of all, Esther says, establish me, like you said. But then, it's an interesting question. Has anyone ever thought of this? Why is the book called Megillat Esther? Right, there's Mordechai, there's the rest of the Jews, there's lots of people. Why not just call it Megillat Purim? Right? But so there's something about Esther's character that puts her as the centerpiece of this conversation. So how did she get there? So let me ask you a question. And if you want to answer, great. I'd love to hear from as many of you as possible. How would you characterize? Think of the story as you know it. How would you characterize? We'll start at the beginning of the story, specifically. Okay, let's remember the beginning of the story. How would you characterize Esther as a person? How would you define her in terms of her? In terms of her strength of character, in terms of how she carries herself. In terms of what happens to her, what is done to her, what she does, active, passive, what do you make of her when you read the story? Any takers?
I'd say she's vulnerable yet strategic.
She's vulnerable. Okay, let's start. Yes, strategic. So, how invulnerable in what way?
I think she's vulnerable in that she is an orphan, and our tradition tells us that orphans are naturally vulnerable. She's in a situation where she doesn't have the standard protection. So, you know, Mordechai, whether he's her cousin or uncle or husband, is this kind of person that kind of is her protector because she doesn't have standard protection.
Okay, so she is vulnerable. She's an orphan. The Talmud says that her father died after she was conceived, and her mother died during or right after childbirth. Possibly, she never met her parents. She never lived a day with parents. Mordechai takes her in, so she is vulnerable. Okay, excellent. Maura, were you about to say something? I wasn't sure. I thought I heard two voices.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and maybe it's just how I was taught as a kid. Like I never thought much of her. She just kind of seemed not, I don't want to say a puppet. Like she just seemed like she just did what she was told. I was not taught of her as a strong woman. And I'm that's part of why I was like, I want to go to this class. Cause I want to change that view of her. It's just not how I was ever taught her.
Okay. So, she seems like, very passive. As Maura said, do as she was told. And we're going to see that certainly at the beginning of the story, that is one way to certainly read the text. That maybe is certainly the straightforward way to read the text, I think. Okay, anyone else have a take?
To put a more positive spin on it, I might call her a work in progress.
Very interesting, a work in progress. So, but what are we working from, and what are we working to? What's the scale, David?
Well, passive all the way through to what we're reading right now about the desire to have her book canonized.
What we're going to try to figure out is if in fact that's correct, which is a work in progress. What was, to use contemporary language, the tipping point? Right, that moved her. Right, great. Okay, excellent. Anyone else want to weigh in? Maura, I loved what you did that you shared with us, that you have this this age old vision or understanding of Esther that you've had since, it sounds like, since you were first aware of your awareness of Esther, and that it's always been the same for you. And so that's why we learn, right? To learn new things. That's great. Okay. Let's house looks great, by the way. Okay. All right. Let's look at the beginning of the book and how Esther is portrayed. I just want to make sure there's no one stuck in the waiting room. Hold on a second here. Okay, I think we're good. Okay, great. So, if we look at some of the elements at the beginning, now we're in, and Stacey, I enlarged it. I hope it's better now. At the beginning of the book, this is chapter 2. We have, this is after, after Ahasuerus gets enraged at the party because Vashti will listen to him. And another year we'll talk about Vashti, another year we'll talk about all these many characters. After Ahasuerus gets enraged and does away with Vashti, and by the way, the Megillah, another thing that maybe we could talk about is that the Megillah never says that Ahasuerus kills Vashti, right? Even though that's what we learn in school. It's just she's gone, she's out of the picture, exit stage right. Whichever little girl plays Vashti in the play just walks off the stage and we never see her again. But now they have the beauty pageant, and here's what happens. Right? Let's see the difference between Esther and everyone else. Okay? So, Uvehigia tur na'arav na'ara lavo al melech Ahasuerus. They're having this beauty pageant, and they're all coming to Ahasuerus, and they're all presumably coming because they want to be chosen. Right? They, Miketze yod lakedat anashim, at the end of 12 months, treatment prescribed for the women, that was the period spent on beautifying them, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and women's cosmetics. So all the women, right, they participated by anointing themselves and bathing themselves, and getting ready for 12 months, 6 months of one type of treatment, and six months with another type of treatment. That's all the other women. Now, when it comes to Esther, uvegia tor Esther bat Abichail. We're now down on pasuk tetvav 15, and when it came Esther's turn, daughter of Abichail, uncle of Mordechai, which is really interesting, by the way. We already know who she is. I'm just thinking about this now. We know that she's. That she's the daughter of Abichail. She's who's we know her lineage. Like the fact that it's telling us this also tells me like she has no identity of her own. She's not Esther. She's Esther, who's this relative and this relative. She doesn't stand on her own as a person at this point. In any case, it's her turn. Lo baksha davar ki met asher yomar hegai saris hamelech shomer nashim. So two things stand out to me in this sentence. One is, it feels like, I don't want to disparage Esther, but it feels like a little country bumpkin, right? All the other women, they got the 6 months of this type of perfume and 6 months of this type of perfume. And Esther, she's not taking any of it. And she doesn't, the way she operates is ki imet asher yomar hegai saris hanashim, saris hamelach. All she does is what Hegai says to do. She's not making any decisions on her own. Now, vati Esther no seid chen b'nei koroeha, that may be why, right? She's like, everyone loves her because she just does what everyone tells her to do. Right? Everyone loves that person. She doesn't assert any independence at all. She listens to what Haggai says. She's not demanding at all. She doesn't seem to want to take care of herself the way all the other women want to take care of herself. Right? So Esther here, even at the very beginning, we're getting this picture of her. And as we're, if anyone has a comment or anything they want to add or question about this, don't hesitate. The picture we're getting of Esther is, as I labeled
Rabbi Gelman.
Passive and what I call it, passive and generic, right? She's, I guess, what the kids would say, basic, right? Esther's basic, okay? Now, the Gemara goes on, she's beautiful. Everyone thought she was beautiful. She may have been, but basic. Yeah. Okay. Who wanted to say something?
Oh, well, yeah. It's Hannah. And hey. Well, I guess I relate back to when I was a kid and my family and I, we dressed up to go to Shul for Purim. My mom always said Esther was beautiful, was naturally beautiful. So that's just, what my take on that was. She was a beauty.
Huh. So she didn't need it. She didn't take this stuff because she was naturally beautiful.
Yeah. That's what my mom said.
Yeah. And your mom is echoing the Talmud, right? The Talmud says she was in fact beautiful. And that's certainly one way to understand this for sure. And I think.
Isn't that why he picks her?
Pardon?
Isn't that why he picks her? I feel like I was taught. Like that.
Well, he certainly thought she was beautiful.
Yeah, like it had to do with her beauty, perhaps also with her humility.
There's no indication that that Ahasuerus gave them, an IQ test. Right? There may have been other sorts of acumen that he was testing, but it wasn't their brain. okay.
One comment for me real quick. I've always had the impression, it conveys a little bit of maturity. I've got all these other young girls running around getting their toys and whatever, presents and candy and whatever it is they want, and she's above it all.
Okay, great. Good, I like it. Okay. If we continue, we see another time where Esther, it's unclear if she had her own idea, but the Megillah goes out of its way to tell us that she was, she was a good listener. She was good at obeying other people's demands. So this is still chapter 2, verse 16 through 20. Esther is taken to Ahasuerus, and in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she won his grace. And so she became the queen. And then they had a banquet, which was called Mishte Esther, right? He named the banquet for her. There was a little bit of a tax remission, a little tax holiday in her honor. And then Mordechai is watching this from a distance. And in verse 20, Ein Esther Magedet Moladeta Ve'et Ama Kasher Tziva Aleha Mordechai. So first of all, Esther did not reveal her kindred or her people as Mordechai had instructed her. So I think there are at least two ways to read this pasuk. One is, proactively, Mordechai said, Esther, listen, don't tell Ahasuerus you're Jewish. The other is, hey, Mordechai, hey, Uncle Mordechai, or maybe, hey, husband, because maybe they were married, according to the Gemara, I think I should tell Ahasuerus I'm Jewish. And Mordechai said, no, don't do that. But either way, she's listening to Mordechai. And the Megillah goes out of its way to tell us that she's listening to Mordechai. And then, again, the Megillah says, that Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Asa Hasher Haita Ba'amna Ito. Esther obeyed Mordechai's bidding as she had done when she was under his tutelage, right? So Mordechai is like the puppeteer, He is controlling Esther from a distance. Remember, he is sitting at the end of 19. It says, Mordechai Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. Mordechai sat in the palace gate. Mordechai is not in proximity to Esther, yet Esther is still controlled by him. Okay, so she is not making a move without him. Now, there are different ways to, we could say that maybe she was unsure of herself. She was young. This is palace intrigue, and Mordechai was more experienced. And maybe, as David said, this is a wise, mature move. Or Esther is just passive, generic, basic, indecisive, which, again, is not necessarily bad. But that's where there are a lot of hints in this text. Now, this is what we've seen so far are the texts of the Megillah. The rabbinic texts bolster this. A few really interesting rabbinic texts in the Midrash. So this Midrash, source number 6. Uvigia Torah Esther, telling us when it was Esther's turn, but yeah, Esther no seit chen b'nei koreah. And Esther found favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. With the arrival of the turn of Esther, Esther found favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. I'm reading the English on the left here. Rabbi Yehuda says, like that portrait that 1,000 people look at, and it is beautiful to them all. Rabbi Nehemiah says, they positioned Median women on one side, the Persian women on the other side. Esther was more beautiful than them all. The rabbi said Esther found favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. So as you said, more, she was beautiful. But especially, I think a modern person could read this Midrash in a very interesting way, right? Esther was she was like turned into she was like a commodity, right? That just people would, people would look at her. That's, people just would stare at her, right? Like a portrait, like you would at a beautiful picture, right? That's the, and by the way, what is a picture? Completely passive, just hangs on the wall. It's not like Harry Potter where the pictures move. Right. This is a portrait of a completely passive person, and it's interesting that this is the imagery that the Midrash uses about her. On the one hand, there's a sort of a compliment that she was beautiful, and everyone who saw her thought she was beautiful. Yeah, like a portrait that 1,000 people look at.
Can I interject one idea?
Sure. Yeah.
If that's all it really was, you would think that the other girls or women would be jealous of her, but it says specifically that they all loved her. So it seems to me she brought more to the table from that, especially from that comment, than just beauty. Otherwise, you know, she could be a source of scorn by everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that there was more. I'm not saying that all there was is beauty. What I'm suggesting is that she was a very passive person, and that the use of this language of portrait does not seem to be accidental. In contemporary times. Right, we're very sensitive to images of women that men just gawk at, right? And that seems to be what's going on here, and so it feels again like this sort of passivity on her part. And here's another one: Vatilakach Esther El Hamelech Achashverosh. So the language of the Megillah itself, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus. Now, of course, we would say she was taken because those were the rules. If Ahasuerus called you, he sent his henchmen to your home and he took you. But again, that language just jumps off at you. She was taken completely against her will, passively. Doesn't say she put up a fight. Again, maybe that wouldn't have been smart, but she, and then the Midrash says she was rising in price. This one said, I will give 100 dinars to escort her to the king. And that one said, I will give 200. So now not only was she like a commodity in the previous Midrash, she was literally a commodity in this Midrash. People were literally willing to pay for the opportunity just to escort her to the king's palace. That's how beautiful or enchanting she was. She was bought and sold. And one other midrash, and two other rabbinic statements that sort of, again, just building up this picture of Esther, both in the text and in the rabbinic mind, as you said, David, maybe a work in progress. So Esther Rabbah, on the pasuk that talks about Esther not telling anyone who she was, Ein Esther Magedet Moladeta. She did not disclose her family. Melamed Shetafsa Shtika Beatzma Kirachel Ziknita Shetafsa Telech Shtika. This is really an incredible midrash. That she, Esther, followed in the footsteps of Rachel, her ancestor, who also practiced silence. When did Rachel practice silence? When
Yaakov married Leah.
Right. When Yaakov married Leah, she kept silent. And here too, Leah keeps silent. Rata savlonoteha biyalachota v'shaka. She saw the betrothal gifts. This is talking about Rachel and Leah, and she kept silent. So again, the rabbi is just like piling on this character trait of Esther. And this notion of silence is very important because at the end of the story, right, what do we need Esther to do? We need her to do one thing. Speak. Right? All we need her to do is speak. But over and again, we're told that she was silent. She didn't tell anyone anything, that she let them take her. They were watching her. Right? At the beginning of the story, she's totally quiet. She just does what everyone tells her to do. She doesn't ask for anything. Right. Even though, David, you make a good point. She's mature. She's not running after all the fancy video games in the palace. But the picture, like I'm trying to like create a picture for myself. If we made a movie about this, which was true to the text, I wonder for the first half of the movie if Esther would have any line in the dialogue.
I hear you, Rabbi. I don't know. I've just grown up always having this image. Maybe it's wrong. Just as a woman on a mission, she knew what she was there for. And
At the beginning, I wonder, what does she say at the beginning? Maybe she says, when Haggai says, do you want some perfume? She says, no, thank you. Maybe that's her line. But she's not winning any Oscars for the big dialogue in the first half of the movie. Because she doesn't tell anyone she's Jewish. She doesn't ask for anything in the palace. When they come together, she just looks like she goes silently. Right? So it's. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Well, I've always had that opposite view. Not that she's a woman on a mission, but she doesn't want to be there. But she's there against her will, right? The king calls all the women, you have to go. And so she doesn't speak. She's in fear. She doesn't want to be there.
It's kind of so maybe she's not speaking because she's afraid.
Like, why is she there? Like, why doesn't she just say no? But you can't say no to that,
right? Hey, who just joined? Who's Davis? I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. I'd love to say hello.
It's Stephen Davis.
Hello there. Welcome.
Hey, Rabbi. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming on. Okay. Yeah, we're just spending a little too much time building up a terrible impression of Esther, which we're going to try to undo in a few minutes. So just bear with us. Then the Gemara in Chulin, in source number 9, Esther min HaTorah minayan. Sometimes the rabbis do this. They want a hint of something that happened after the Torah was written. They want to, if there's some sort of allusion in the Torah. I'm not sure if they're really looking for an allusion in the Torah, or if it's like a memory, or it's some sort of thematic connection to the Torah. So what's the thematic connection between Esther and anything in the Torah? So this is really, really interesting. Vanochi Hashter Aftir, a pasuk that says in Devarim, in Deuteronomy 31:18, where in the Torah can one find an allusion to the events involving Esther? He replied to them that the verse says, then my anger shall be kindled against them on that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall come upon them, etc., and I will hide. Right, the language is similar. Vanochi haster astir. We hear the similarity between the word has, the words haster astir, and the word Esther. And those words haster astir mean that God will hide His face. So I think there are two things going on in this Gemara. One, if you may have heard this before, right? God's name does not appear in the Megillah. Right, so the presence of God is hidden in the Megillah, in the story. But who also is hidden in the story, so to speak? Esther is hidden in the story. Like at the beginning of the story, there's no Esther. Like again, if we're going to go back to the movie version of the story, you could make the movie with almost no images of Esther at the beginning of the movie. You could have her being whisked away from her house, and then she doesn't show up till a little bit later. Right? Esther is silent and almost, this is even stronger, silent and almost invisible. Now, this may be a little overkill to make the point, right? But let's see Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. All right. Can I get a volunteer to read source number 10? Make it bigger. Any takers?
All right. Sure.
All right. Thanks, David.
Aside from her beauty, Esther lacks any distinguishing characteristics. Although there was public significance to her entry into the royal palace, there's really nothing that gives her spiritual or national prominence. Gemara comments, where does the Torah hint at Esther? From the words, I shall surely hide my face. This is a play on the similarity of the words Aster, Astir, and the name Esther. At the beginning of the Megillah, it is not only the divine presence which is hidden, Esther herself is hidden from us. Esther did not mention her birthplace or her nationality. There is no Esther. She is a tabula rasa. No national identity, no moral identification, no roots, and no background. Rather, she projects the type of generic cosmopolitan image of one who hails from some unknown part of the 127 provinces and arrives at the royal palace. No one knows whether she's a Medi or a Persian, from the north or from the south. Only one thing is known. She is beautiful and charming. But what is her identity? What is her character? What philosophy drives her?
Okay. So we've built that place by careful reading of some text of the Megillah itself and unpacking some rabbinic texts from the Midrash and the Gemara. But as we know, right, this is not the Esther that Hannah, that your mother told you to dress up as, right?
Correct.
Right. This is not the Esther that we, although this is, it's what really interesting. Mora's Esther and Hannah's Esther are different Esthers. It sounds like Hannah grew up with an Esther that she thought was super cool, and Mora grew up with an Esther that was a little disappointing. So that's, which is, I guess, the way Torah is supposed to be, right? We all see Torah and read Torah and understand Torah differently. That's what we call Shivim Panim LaTorah. There are 70 faces of Torah. So, but we know that's not the way the story ends. The way the story ends is, of course, Esther steps up big time. So what happened? Right. So let's spend a few minutes on the what happened, on that tipping point of Esther. Okay. So Esther 1, if you go back to the beginning, these are Rabbi Lichtenstein's categories. Esther 1, we have called passive and generic. And now Esther 2, we have called active and proudly Jewish. Okay. Then Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, wrote a second letter of Purim for the purpose of confirming with full authority the aforementioned one of Mordechai the Jew. So now we see Esther coming to her own. She writes a letter to all the Jewish people about everything that happened, and that whatever Mordechai said, I'm telling you that that's true. Right? It's like she's the important one, not Mordechai, which also helps us understand again why it's called Megillat Esther. I'm the important. Okay. So now back to the heart of the story. After Haman's decree is known, Mordechai is sitting in the outside the palace in sackcloth and ashes. And Esther's maidens and eunuchs come and informed her. The queen was greatly agitated. She sent clothing for Mordechai to wear so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he refused. So here, we're at a middle ground. Let's unpack this, right? Let's see what's happening. Mordechai, who up until now has been the puppeteer in charge of Esther, is sitting in the courtyard in sackcloth. And here for the first time, what do we see? Esther.
She tries to take care of him.
She does something. Exactly. She tries to control him. Now, it doesn't work. The low-key bail, but it's a start. Right? There's a crack in the armor. And for the first time, Esther says, now, we're not sure why. Maybe she just doesn't like to call, she doesn't want to call attention to this. By the way, it's an interesting question. Just, for those of you who feel we're being a little too hard on Esther, there is a debate whether Esther knew about this decree or not. Because the decree was sent out from the palace to the Jews and the people of Shushan. It's unclear whether Esther, who's inside the palace and not part of the governmental intrigue and structure, knew. You could also argue that that's maybe a little far-fetched, right? That she didn't know. So she may have not known until even after this. So she's saying, Mordechai, what are you doing? You can't dress this way. What's going on? Because she may have not known yet. But on the other hand, it's a strong possibility that she did. Just to give her the benefit of the doubt, since we spent, 42 and a half minutes speaking not so nicely about Esther's character. Okay. So she starts. Back to Rav Lichtenstein. What eventually drives her to act? Mordechai disturbs her complacency. The entire nation of Israel faces mortal danger, and this she's able to bear. But then she hears that her beloved adoptive father Mordechai has removed his regular clothing and is wearing sackcloth instead. And she sent clothing to Mordechai to remove the sackcloth, but he did not accept. Instead of trying to have the royal decree annulled, instead of expressing solidarity with her people, instead of joining Mordechai in protest and mourning, she begs him to stop the nonsense, to accept the decree. Again, maybe that's true, maybe she didn't know. Despite everything, this still represents progress. She no longer is completely inactive. Something has started to move, and once she shows active concern for an individual, Mordechai, once the mire of passivity has abandoned, things start to happen. So now, I guess colloquially, this is a snowball effect, right? She, according to Rav Lichtenstein, she knows what's going on. She doesn't act on the decree to save her people. She is concerned about Mordechai, but once she's concerned about one person and actually starts to act on it, then there's a crack in the armor, as I said, and she starts to do other things. And here we go. So now let's backtrack. Mordechai learned that it happened. This is the beginning. We just were in the middle of chapter 4 with this whole back and forth with Esther and the sackcloth. Now we back up to the beginning of chapter 4. Mordechai learned what happened. He tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes. He's sitting out loud and he's crying. And then Esther sees that. And he refuses to change. And then verse 5, therefore Esther summoned Hatach, whom the king had appointed to serve her, and sent him to Mordechai to learn why and wherefore of it all. And Hatach went out, and Mordechai told him that it happened. And he gave a written text of the law. So this is where you may come to the point that actually Esther did not know. Because now Hatach delivers in verse 9 Mordechai's message to Esther. And then Esther says, oh, okay, this is bad. But what am I going to do? All the king's courtiers and the people in the king's provinces know that if any person, man or woman, enters the king's presence in the inner court without having been summoned, there is but one law for them to be put to death, and I have not been summoned for 30 days. So let's give Esther the benefit of the doubt. That the first time she sees Mordechai in sackcloth, she did not know about this decree. Now she knows about it. And Mordechai expects her to go to Ahasuerus, but she's the only one with access to him. And she said, I can't go to Ahasuerus. She's going to kill me if I go to Ahasuerus. Because that's the rule. You can't go to him unless he summons you, and he hasn't summoned me for 30 days. This is the pivotal moment of the whole story. Chapter 4, whatever happens next is the moment. You want to remember what happens next? This is the dialogue. It's not really a dialogue between Mordechai and Esther. It's a dialogue between Mordechai and Esther via a messenger. Right? The messenger comes and goes and tells Mordechai to change. He says no. He says, hey, why don't you tell Esther about what Haman did? And then Esther says, well, you have to tell Mordechai, I can't go to Ahasuerus because he's going to kill me. And then Mordechai says, he lowers the boom. Did she say something?
Oh, it's just like this dramatic, famous moment. And he just like kind of challenges her to basically saying that you may be close to power and protect it, but if you don't speak up, salvation's going to come from somewhere else. You might miss your moment, okay. You know?
So he says a few things to her, right? He says first, when Mordechai was told what Esther had said, Mordechai had this message from Esther. Do not imagine that you, of all the Jews, will escape with your life by being in the king's palace. So how does Mordechai understand Esther at this point?
I think he understands that she's might have gotten used to this bubble of seeming protection.
Right. And that
gotten comfortable.
Yeah, and that what? She's gonna be okay. And right, and she seems to be saying, okay, you know what? Everyone else is gonna be killed, but I'm gonna be okay. And he's like, don't think that you're going to survive this. Meaning, it's amazing what he thinks of her. Either she is his niece or his wife or cousin. Those are the three options the Gemara entertains, I think. Wife, niece, or cousin. Either way, it's terrible. He says, you think that you're going to let the rest of us die and you're going to survive? That's like a terrible indictment of someone. Here's Rav Lichtenstein's words. What a biting accusation. It would seem that he should have told her, you don't want to do anything? Then don't. You're cowardly and lacking in any initiative. You haven't been called to the king in 30 days? So what? That would have put Esther in a more positive light. It is terrible that you are not prepared to risk yourself, even at the expense of the entire nation, but still it's a result of an inherent weakness. However, Mordechai doesn't attribute a response to weakness. He pushes this fault all the way, appealing to the deepest recess of the Jewish soul. He accuses Esther of being going to the king, not because she lacks courage, not out of weakness, but rather as a calculated choice. Let the entire Jewish nation be destroyed, let them all perish, young and old, men and women. I will remain secure in the royal house. Wow. Don't forget about her being passive. At this point, Mordechai accuses her of basically, as Rav Lichtenstein says, a calculated choice. I'm going to let all these people die, and I'm going to live. And Rav Lichtenstein says it would have been better had she said, I'm afraid. I'm afraid he's going to kill me if I go to him. But that's not how he understood it. He understood it as her saying, I'm just not going to go. And if I don't go, I'm going to be okay, even though the rest of you are going to be killed. Okay, so that's pretty bad. You thought I was going to rehabilitate Esther right away. Not so fast. Okay. So then it goes on. Then Mordechai goes on. On the contrary, ki im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. If you are silent at this moment, revach v'hatzala yamod la'yudim mimakom acher. First of all, salvation will come from somewhere else. Now, it's theologically, that's an interesting question, what that means. Right? How does Mordechai know that? He was a prophet, but unclear. It could mean that the Jewish people will live on, even though the Jews of Shushan and the people in the rest of the provinces of Ahasuerus are going to be massacred. The Jewish people will survive. Ve'at ubeit avich tovedu, but you are not going to survive. Meaning, don't think that, you know, the Jews in high places get away. They're also going to be killed, and you're going to be killed with them. And this is the, I think, the best part of this. You're wondering, Esther, why you were torn away from your family and rushed to the palace and you know, mistreated and treated like a commodity. Maybe this is why. Like you said, Stacy, maybe this is your moment. And if you don't rise to this moment, you may be wasting this opportunity of a lifetime. Like, you're only given the opportunity to save the Jewish people once. And this is your chance. Right? So he says to her, he says three things. One is the Jewish people are going to be fine. Okay? So don't think that just because if you're not going to go, the Jewish people are finished. We're going to be okay. Like, I think what he means is, we may not be okay, but we are going to be okay. Two, you're not going to be okay. And three, right? People are sometimes given like a mission. And it's rare that it's so obvious what it is. And this may be yours. Don't blow it. And this is Rabbi Lichtenstein's read. He tells Esther, your calculations are mistaken. Not only does your response demonstrate moral debasement, but you are mistaken in the practical sense as well. Do you believe that everyone will perish and you will remain there in the royal palace just because you have succeeded in entering the king's bedroom? Is that how you think God runs his world? Someone who avoids any responsibility, who doesn't care, who isn't prepared to risk herself, who sets her personal ambitions over the interests of the nation, is that the person you think will survive? Meaning, so interesting, the Lichtenstein's words are so powerful. That's not the way God operates. Right? God doesn't operate the world by allowing people who shirk their responsibility, who shirk their moral responsibility, to win. Now, sometimes it does feel that way. But Mordechai is saying it doesn't work that way. Right? That's not the way God runs the world. Will she be the one to succeed? Will all values just disappear and your father's house and you and your father's house will perish? For if you remain silent this time, relief from the eventual rise of Jews, where else your salvation will come? I don't know how or from where, but it will come. Those who pay heed to some consideration and circumstances, the doubters and cowards of many types, those who put themselves first, all of these will perish. Who knows, perhaps for the sake of a time such as this, you have come to join the royalty. Now is 0 hour. This is the test. I mean, that is a pep talk. The only pep talk that comes close is the pep talk that Herb Brooks gave before the 1980 Olympic hockey gold medal game against the Russians. That's the only thing that comes close. This is the world's best pep talk. That was the world's second best pep talk. You should look it up. You should watch it. It's on YouTube. At least the one from the movie Miracle is on YouTube. And I don't know if that's the real one, but that's a good one. Okay, so this is a great pep talk because then it works. Then Esther says, okay, Mordechai, you're right. And this, David, this is the turning point. What's so interesting is the rest of the story of the, like, this is the highlight of the Megillah. We have another five chapters of banquets and hanging, and it's anticlimactic after this point. Okay. After Esther does her thing, right, this is the moment. Vatomer Esther Lashiva Mordechai. And by the way, what's really interesting about this is none of this is in person or Zoom. This is Mordechai telling Hatach, go tell Esther, we're going to live, you're going to die, and maybe this is why you're queen. And then, you know, back in the movie version, Esther, Mordechai says, we're going to live, you're going to die, right? And then he runs back, right? Like, imagine how powerful his pep talk would have been if it was in person. But this is not even in person. And then Esther said, okay, go tell Mordechai to tell the Jews to go fast for 3 days. And then she says, v'kasher avadati avadati. If I die, I die. That's the moment. She's willing to put her life on the line. And listen to this. Back to our theme. Vayavor Mordechai vayas kefol asher tzivta alav Esther. Now who's the puppeteer and who's the puppet? It's a total flip. In fact, the theme of Purim is v'nahafochu, that everything is turned upside down. The Jews were going to be killed. Our enemies are killed. Haman was on top. Haman's on the bottom. Mordechai was on the bottom. Mordechai's on top. And now we have another one. Esther was controlled by Mordechai, and now Mordechai is controlled by Esther. Right? This pasuk, this end of this verse is so powerful. Vayas kichol asher tzivta alav Esther. Well, before, Esther did everything, Mordechai did everything Esther said. Before we read that Esther did everything Haggai said, and Esther did everything Mordechai said, Esther was listening and following what everyone else was saying, and now people are listening to Esther. Esther has flipped the script. Mordechai helped her with that speech, but in the end, Esther is in charge. And now, not only that, Mordechai becomes a little meek now. What happens in this midrash? Vatomer Esther l'hashiv Mordechai amra lo lech kenos et kol yudim hanimzim mishtem v'tzimo alai ve'al tochlu ve'al tishtu shloshet yamim. Mordechai, Esther said to Mordechai, okay, go get everyone and tell them to fast 3 days. What 3 days were they? Elu hein yud gimel v'yud dalad v'tetvav Nisan. 13th, 14th, and 15th of Nisan, which also happens to be the first day of Pesach, on which you can't fast. So Esther says to Mordechai, go tell the Jews to fast on the first day of Pesach. You can't fast on Pesach because you have to eat matzah, maror, 4 cups of wine. You have to fulfill the mitzvah of Pesach. Not allowed to fast. So now Mordechai is like fumfing around. Esther, sorry, sweetie, it's the first day of Pesach. Maybe you could move the fast next week. Not right to fast, right? Elohim shalach la v'harei b'hem yom yishon shel Pesach. Mordechai goes back and says, Esther, hey, sweetie, it's Pesach. Amra lo, she says to him, Zakein shebi Yisrael, elder of Israel, lama hu Pesach. what's Pesach for? Right? If we're all dead, what good is Pesach? What are you trying to save Pesach for if we're going to die? Or Pesach's about our freedom. What story of our freedom is there going to be if we're all dead? Meaning she not only is now controlling Mordechai, she's uprooting Pesach from the Torah, at least for that 1 year. Miyad, again, Shama Mordechai v'hoda l'divareha. Immediately, Mordechai agrees. And that's why the Pasuk says, Vayas kechol asher tzipa alav Esther, he does everything he says to do. Kaman Amrin she'evir yom tov shel Pesach betanit. That he violated the first day of Pesach. So we have Esther, who goes from the silent one, almost the invisible one, to the woman who tells Mordechai, who was a prophet and part of the Knesset HaGedolah, that it's okay to uproot a biblical holiday. And like then we go back to the beginning of the story and tells the Chachamim to add a book to the Torah. Ketuvuni l'dorot, make my story part of the canon. So we have this incredible transition of Esther throughout the story. It's our national story of redemption and survival and salvation. But if you focus on Esther and on her personality, it's a story of taking responsibility. It's a story of growing up. It's a story of finding your voice. It's a story of bravery, ultimate bravery, right? She did really risk her life at the end, and a real turnaround, a real v'nahafuhu from the one who we read at the beginning again and again and again. She was listening and did whatever everyone else told her to do to the one who is giving the orders. And by the way, we skipped a bunch. She goes to Achashverosh. Achashverosh says, what do you want? I'll give you half my kingdom. Make a party. Okay, I'll make a party. She comes back. What do you want? Make another party. Okay, I'll make another party. Right? In the end, she's telling everyone what to do. Right? So there's a complete change in Esther after Mordechai sort of shakes her up and says that key word, which I think that's the key. Umi yodea, right? Umi yodea in le'et kazot he got the machlokes. Who knows? Perhaps you have attained royal position just for this. Maybe this is your moment. So it's a beautiful story about Esther's change, and I think a very inspirational point about life. Right? We all have moments of choice, and we never know why we've been put in a specific situation. And sometimes we have to sort of embolden ourselves to make a move and to take charge, because that may be our moment. And I often think about this phrase at the end of Pasuk Yudalet, at times like that. So that is Megillat Esther, at least from the perspective of Esther the Queen finding her voice and going through this real change from how she is in the first three and a half chapters of the story versus the rest of the story. And thank you for joining. And any final comments or questions?
There's another message I'm finding equally powerful, which is the emphasis on behavior rather than motivation. Because I think one could argue that until she was told that she was going to die if she didn't do anything, she was passive and not willing to help. But as soon as she realized and came to the conclusion she was going to die unless she did something, then she acted. So one could argue, okay, maybe that mitigate, you know, that offsets some of the beauty of what you, or the not beauty, but the positive of what she did. But this is just emphasizing, oh, it doesn't matter what her motivation was. Right, she did the right thing.
Great. Good. Thank you. Morik, I put you on the spot. How are we feeling about Esther now?
I mean, I appreciated it, right? That idea of her really, because the way I was, I don't think I ever learned that. I don't know, we must have skipped Perek Daled. Like, I don't remember ever learning those specifics of, and Mordechai taking that opinion of her. So that, I think, was a change for me in thinking that she did this and not just continued to do what she was told, because I was still always thought like, okay, well, he told her to do something, so she did something. So it did expand it a little bit.
Okay, great. I'm going to link the article in the chat.
Oh, good.
Rav Lichtenstein's article, and give everyone a minute to open that up in their own browser if you want to read the whole article or print it out and save it for your Shabbos reading. You can do that. It's certainly worthwhile reading.
Excellent. Thank you. I was just writing down a request to follow up with you for it. Perfect.
Yeah. And I hope you enjoy that. And thank you all for joining. I look forward to being back in person. So next week is next Tuesday night starts Purim. Next Wednesday is Purim. So we're not going to meet next. We're not going to meet.
Mm-hmm. It's Monday night.
Am I mixing up my days?
Yeah, it's Monday night. Monday and night Tuesday.
Purim. I'm sorry. Shushan Purim. So we are going to meet. I'm sorry. We are on for the 8th. Excellent. Thank you, Maura, for setting me straight. We are going
to
meet.
If you want to give me an extra day to practice, because I haven't opened my tikkun for Megillah since last year, I'll take it, but I'm pretty sure it's Monday.
We are. Thank you. Yeah, we are going to meet. And